The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome to the final reading for December of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This, of course, is the final reading for the year 2023, and it's going to be the final reading for me, your host, Fred Brack, who's had the pleasure of reading to you for the last 24 years, I believe it is, of Our State magazine. More on that at the end of the program. Let's get reading with a regular writer for Our State, T. Edward Nickens, and I'll be reading his article for December entitled, Kin and Kindling. During the longest nights of the year, the cozy glow of flickering flames, whether from candles or campfires, draws us close and binds us together. Hunched over the fire ring, lighter in hand, I have my work cut out for me. I have to get a fire started, or else Julie doesn't get to warm her toes and drink wine as the first stars appear over the Blue Ridge Mountains, west of Valley Cruces, and toast marshmallows for her beloved s'mores. I have the three building blocks of fire laid out, tinder, kindling, and fuel. I've shaved a few splinters off a stick of fatwood. My fire-starting bundle looks good, but it's not exactly leaping into flame. I poke it with a stick. It's almost always a good idea to poke at a fire. It makes you feel like you're doing something meaningful. A few feet away, Julie looks at my handiwork, which so far has resulted in a single tiny curlicue of wispy gray smoke twisting out of the twigs. "How's it going over there?" she asks, knowing full well how it's going over here. That woman loves a fire, and I'm feeling the pressure. I can't get that scene from Jack London's famed 1908 short story, To Build a Fire, out of my head. His protagonist is cold, wet, and wandering in the Yukon, and lights all 70 of his matches at once in a desperate attempt to start a life-giving fire. He's unsuccessful, and he dies soon after. Bending low over the fire ring, I separate the fats of curled fatwood and pencil-thick twigs with my poking stick. This infant blaze needs a bit of oxygen. Across the valley, I see campfires dancing through the trees around the campground. Other folks are ahead of me. Inside my fire ring, the smoke intensifies, then suddenly a single flame flickers to life. I blow on the ember, turn my head to the side to gather another lungful of air, and blow a bit harder. The single flame gives rise to another and another. There's crackling and popping and sizzling, and a few sparks bottle rocket into the dark sky overhead. There is fire! Phew! This is the season for cozy fires. Whether you build one in the den of your home, under a mantle crowded with family photos, or in the deepest backcountry of the southern Appalachian wilds, the very act of sparkling a blaze is a touchstone to one of the richest shared experiences of all humanity. We may have traded a flint and steel for a Bic lighter, but little else has changed when it comes to building a fire. The flames catch and grow, crackle and pop. We scooch closer and feel the warmth from head to toe. We've never lived in a house with a working fireplace, so Julie and the kids and I have gone out of our way to have outdoor fires as often as we can. At the grandfather campground on the weekend after Thanksgiving, we would keep a fire going half the day, heating hot chocolate in the morning and apple cider for lunch. Few things in life are as affirming as holding a sleeping child on your lap, one side of their body warmed by a fire, the other warmed by your own flesh and blood. We've lit so many fires in the chiminea on our back deck in Raleigh that we've literally burned through the bottom of the fire pit's lower chamber and now have to slide a cookie pan in place to catch falling embers. There's a fire ring in our backyard in Raleigh, a circle of nearly 100-year-old bricks, and another in our backyard in Moorhead City. At our Blue Ridge campsite, Julie and I sit by the fire as it burns down to a bed of coals. She mentions the giant fireplace that was a centerpiece of her childhood home in Henderson. The hearth was so big you could nap on it, she recalls, smiling. I remember it, a cavernous brick affair that took up half a wall. It seemed like a fire burned there from October to April. I remember the backyard fires that our kids had in their middle and high school years. They and their pals would drag every chair in the house out to the yard, and Julie and I would sneak out to the deck just to catch a glimpse of all their firelit faces below and say a prayer that none of them would ever know a day void of the warmth of friendship. And then, as with just about every fire I've ever been a part of, after the crackling, the light leaping, the blush of heat and revelry, the searing, popping sparks and bottle-rocketing embers, there is the long, silent staring as the flames flicker. The dying fire is evidence of a certain steadfastness. It is older, wiser, something you could rely on. I chuckle when I think that in its last phases, a fire turns gray. I stir the coals with a stick, sending smoke and sparks spiraling upward in a bunch of swirling thermals of heated air. They dance like little bits of laughter from the last few hours by the fire, then wink out in the darkness overhead. Beside me, Julie stretches in her camp chair like a cat awakening from a pleasant nap. We haven't spoken in a while. Mesmerized by the fire, entranced by the embers and the dying flames, we'd retreated into our own thoughts. Now, it's past time to hit the sack. "That was a really nice fire," she says. "Yes, indeed." And I hear her words as a benediction, a sending out of light into the world. Her sweet sentiment is warming to my soul as any fire I've ever built. And now we flash back to the December 15th, 1965 issue of The State magazine. Gifts from my true love. As a present to our readers, we share with you this oft-reprinted twist on the classic carol, The 12 Days of Christmas. written by J.A.C. Dunn. I thought perhaps she'd give me a tie, or an onyx steering wheel knob, or a flask with built-in hairbrushes, or something. But no, on the first day of Christmas, right there in the living room, was a potted pear tree with a partridge sitting in it. An odd present. The pear tree might have borne fruit if planted, but I haven't planted it yet. At that moment, I hadn't any idea what to do with the partridge, either. It seemed a bit callous to eat my true love's Christmas present, particularly when it was given to me alive. I moved the pear tree to a corner of the living room. The partridge didn't stir. In fact, it wouldn't even look at me. I called her up. "Thanks very much for the pear tree and the partridge." "I'm glad you like them," she said. "I've always wanted one of each." "I'm so happy," she said. "And thank you for the subscription, the Vladivostok. And thank you for the subscription to the Vladivostok Herald." The next day, the postman brought a small box with holes in it. It was from her. Inside the box were two birds. The encyclopedia gave a description that matched them. "Turtle dove," it said, noted for its plaintive cooing and affectionate disposition. The turtle doves perched affectionately on the back of an armchair and cooed plaintively. I called her up. "Thanks very much for the turtle doves. They're making love on the armchair right now." "I'm glad you like them," she said. "I just thought I'd give you something else." "What do you feed turtle doves?" "Try turtles," she suggested. She has a literal mind. The next afternoon, a delivery boy brought a slightly larger box, again with holes in it. Three hens huddled inside. One of them immediately made a mess on the hearth, and all three roosted on the mantelpiece, clucking idiotically. I called her up. "Thanks for the hens." "I thought you'd like them," she said. "They're French." I gave the hens popcorn and offered some to the partridge. It ate sullenly, then turned its face to the wall again. The turtle doves cooed with plaintive enthusiasm, but spurned the popcorn. "Sign here," said the postman the next morning. He handed me a large box, again with holes. "What's this?" "Dunno," he said. "Sounds more like birds. What are you starting? A zoo or something?" "No," I said. "And anyway, the word is aviary." The box did indeed contain more birds. Four of them. "Mockingbird," the encyclopedia said, "remarkable for its exact imitation of the notes of other birds." Two of the mockingbirds joined the French hens on the mantelpiece and imitated them. A third joined the turtle doves and cooed. The armchair was beginning to look streaky. The fourth mockingbird joined the partridge and turned its face to the wall. I called her up. "There seems to be an awful lot of birds around here. Thanks, though. I like birds." "Oh, I'm so glad. Maybe you could start a zoo." "You mean aviary," I said, and went out to buy bird seed. The postman rang again the next day. "Birds?" "Nope," the postman said. "Sign here." The small package contained five gold rings, all different. I thought this is a rather broad hint coming from her, but at least they weren't birds. I called her. "Beautiful rings. Thank you." Her reply was very demure. I don't understand why you keep sending me presents, I said to her the next day. It's not that I don't appreciate them, but I should have thought that just one gift. Don't you like the geese? Oh, great geese, I said. Love the geese. They've just arrived. The problem is they keep laying eggs all over the place. One of them's been laying in the bathtub, and I keep having to clean goose egg out of the drain. I'm sorry if they're a bother, she said sweetly. I just wanted... The following morning, four men marched up the driveway carrying a large, inflated plastic wading pool. They set it on the front porch, filled it with water, and then produced from a large box with holes seven swans. They put the swans in the wading pool. I stood mutely watching this operation, and when it was finished, one of the men shook his head sadly at me, and they went away. Look, I said to her over the telephone, I'm very grateful for all you've done, but how about easing off on the birds? I've got 23 now, and this is a pretty small house. Besides, swans bite. She sounded so injured that I hadn't the heart to suggest that she stop sending presents altogether. I wish I had. The next day, eight girls of co-ed age came to the door dressed in full skirts and peasant blouses. We're here, said one when I answered the knock. Who are you? Maids, we've come to milk. She curtsied. I called up my true love. Now look, I said sternly. Fun's fun and all that, but these maids... Now, don't you like maids a-milking? The maids are fine. It's the cows they brought that present a problem. I haven't the space for... Oh, never mind. She had begun to grow tearful. The maids took their cows to the backyard and milked. I fed the birds, bought hay for the cows, laid a stock of TV dinners for the maid. Then I killed the partridge and cooked it. It was getting on my nerves, brooding in the damn pear tree while everything else was cooking or clucking or mocking or laying or swimming. I decided the maids could help eat the steadily increasing supply of goose eggs, which had turned out to be unmarketable. By this time, my dog, a neurotic basset, had retreated to the hall closet and was eyeing activities with a quivering lip. But she wasn't finished. At about 4 the next afternoon, the correct hour for calling, 9 fashionably dressed ladies appeared at the front door. We're here, said the leading lady. Why? We've come to wait, said the leading lady. Wait for what? I asked. But they all walked right past me into the living room, where they sat down and started waiting. My, what a lot of birds, said one. May I have a cigarette? I gave her one and flew to the telephone. What are you trying to do to me? I quavered. I'm not a rich man, and here I have 47 mouths to feed, not counting my own. There are 17 strange women in the house. The place is going wild. Stop, will you? I know you love me. If you want to send me presents, send me a tie or an onyx steering wheel knob. She began to cry. I didn't care about her. I didn't appreciate the love she was trying to show. I was heartless, cruel. The next morning, I was awakened at 6 by pounding. On the front porch were 10 men in brocaded costumes, leaping. The swans snapped at them whenever they got within range of the pool. I hurried outside, panicked. What's all this? Lords, said one of the men laconically, in the middle of a powerful flamenco stamp. Come to leap. He leaped, proving it. Oh, God, How long do you plan to stay? Contract reads 13 weeks with option, said the leading lord, and performed a flying split. Come in, I said wearily. Let me introduce you to some waiting ladies. Hey, hear that, fellas? Girls! They all leaped and pirouetted through the door, and almost immediately the living room sounded like a cocktail party in full swing. As a matter of fact, later in the day, it became just that, with a lord occasionally springing up, highball in hand, to do a spin or an entrechat. I hawked the 5 golden rings, bought 27 TV dinners, more hay, birdseed, 10-gallon cans to keep the cow's milk in, and extra towels. Then I went to work. At work, I got a call from the police. Bunch of guys on your porch having some sort of a jam session, said the desk sergeant. Thought you ought to know. One of my men talked to them, and they was supposed to be there. What's it all about? I hurried home. 11 men sat on the front porch. We're pipers, said one. He was wearing sideburns and sandals. Like, we're going to pipe for you, man. They were all propped against this or that or each other, tooting on recorders. They wore blue jeans and sweatshirts, and one had a bad cough. How long? I asked. Who knows? Till we fade, I guess. Great pad you got here. I got a room in a motel. I didn't even call her up. When I left, the cows had run dry, and the maids and ladies were all reading magazines in the living room, while the lords and pipers had a ball throughout the house. 2 or 3 lord-lady romances were budding. The armchair was encrusted. The bathtub drain was hopelessly clogged. The cows, clustered hungrily at the back door, were anxiously disturbing the peace. The swans attacked anybody who approached their pool. One of the mockingbirds had abandoned the French hens and was imitating the pipers. Another had deserted the turtle doves and was imitating the cows. The French hens had nested in the laundry hamper. The pear tree was beginning to wilt. The spare towels had run out. The dog had had a nervous breakdown and run away, gibbering. I don't know what you'll send me tomorrow, but if it makes any more noise, I'll simply have to leave town. My landlord has threatened to raise the rent, and after all, with 38 people, 22 birds, 8 cows, and an extra tree in the property, can you blame him? In the remaining time that's left, I'd like to read a few short articles about Pittsburgh. When it comes to spreading holiday cheer, the residents of this Chatham County town start early. Written by Chloe Klingstead. Before the turkey has been carved, Christmas comes to downtown Pittsburgh. The Sunday prior to Thanksgiving, an 18-foot-tall Fraser fir, grown in the North Carolina mountains and procured by Phillips Farm of Chatham, is erected in front of the Chatham County Courthouse. Community volunteers wind lights around the evergreen branches in preparation for the town's tree lighting. Just as the founders of Pittsburgh intended when they created infrastructure plans, the 1881 brick courthouse, standing at the center of 4 main roads within a roundabout, remains the heart of the town and of the tree lighting. When the holidays come around, that energy radiates down those roads. Square bushes and trees bordering Hillsborough Street are wrapped in lights and into the brick storefronts that line them. Shop owners set out festive decorations and merchandise so that families can enjoy cups of hot chocolate while sitting at the counter of S&T's soda shop or browse rolls of holiday wrapping paper and bows at Deep River Mercantile. During the season of giving, locals joyfully share their hospitality. Shop, reclamation, Local, Tiana Thurber. In December, Holiday Decor takes center stage at Reclamation Homes Furnishings, a yellow shiplap building that sits on a gravel lot at the end of Fayetteville Street. The shop is well stocked with Christmas items, including wreaths, a ceramic Christmas tree, Santas in various sizes, and shiny bright ornaments, a bestseller this time of year. Owner Tiana Thurber's ancestors were among the first to settle in Chapel Hill around 1793. The Tenney Circle neighborhood in the college town, just 17 miles to the north, is named for her six times great-grandfather, Oregon Tenney. Thurber grew up scoping out vintage items on her family's Orange County homestead and browsing the antique jewelry in her grandmother's vanity. There was a lot of history in my grandmother's house. She says, when I got into the world, I could recognize antiques, and items have value. Since taking ownership of Reclamation in 2020, Thurber has connected folks with treasures from the past. True to her roots, she maintains a large display of antique jewelry, including pieces from the Victorian, Art Deco, and mid-century eras. Festivities at Furington. Enjoy the holiday decorations and sip seasonal libations at Furington Village, former farmland that was transformed into an English-inspired village more than 40 years ago. Stop in to hear Appalachian storyteller Donald Davis experience the fine dining and accommodations at the Furington House Inn and the Furington House Restaurant. Find new reads at McIntyre's Books and More. 2000 Furington Village Center, Furington.com. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. We've heard the last reading of December 2023 as we're getting ready to move on to 2024. And in doing so, I bring to a conclusion my own reading of Our State magazine. I've been doing it for about 24 years, first for Linda Ornt, the director of the reading service, and now more recently May Tran, with assistance from Missy Hollander, who coordinates all the programming. It's been my pleasure to read to you. I hope you've enjoyed the time that I've spent with you, and that you'll continue to enjoy Our State magazine with its new reader. Today's reading of Our State magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions? Call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.